creating remarkably favorable terms of trade for those very states. Korea, Japan, Taiwan, certain favored allies in Southeast Asia that had been the traditional Chinese tributaries, in this case, in order to contain China. Bearing all this in mind, the current picture begins to fall easily back into place. When the US was far and away the predominant world economic power, it could afford to maintain Chinese-style tributaries. Thus, these very states, alone amongst US military protectorates, were allowed to catapult themselves out of poverty and into first-world status. After 1971, as U.S. economic strength relative to the rest of the world began to decline, they were gradually transformed back into a more old-fashioned sort of tributary. Yet China's getting in on the game introduced an entirely new element. There's every reason to believe that, from China's point of view, this is the first stage of a very long process of reducing the U.S. to something like a traditional Chinese client state. And of course, Chinese rulers are not, any more than the rulers of any other empire, motivated primarily by benevolence. There's always a political cost, and what that headline marked was the first glimmerings of what that cost might ultimately be. All that I have said so far serves to underline a reality that has come up constantly over the course of this book, that money has no essence. It's not really anything. Therefore, its nature has always been, and presumably always will be, a matter of political contention. This was certainly true throughout the earlier stages of U.S. history, incidentally, as the endless 19th century battles between gold bugs, greenbackers, free bankers, bimetallists, and the silverites so vividly attest, or, for that matter, the fact that the American voters were so suspicious of the very idea of central banks that the Federal Reserve System was only created on the eve of World War I, 3 centuries after the Bank of England. Even the monetization of the national debt is, as I've already noted, double-edged. It can be seen, as Jefferson saw it, as the ultimate pernicious alliance of warriors and financiers. But it also opened the way to seeing government itself as a moral debtor, of freedom as something literally owed to the nation. Perhaps no one put it so eloquently as Martin Luther King, Jr., in his I Have a Dream speech, delivered on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in 1963.
In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds.
One can see the great crash of 2008 in the same light, as the outcome of the years of political tussles between creditors and debtors, rich and poor. True, on a certain level, it was exactly what it seemed to be, a scam, an incredibly sophisticated Ponzi scheme designed to collapse in the full knowledge that the perpetrators would be able to force the victims to bail them out. On another level, it could be seen as the culmination of a battle over the very definition of money and credit. And that's where we're going to leave David Graeber for this week. Certainly that second point needs expanding, but we're going to do that in a forthcoming show. Now, we're now going to have a quick music break, but before we do so, I'm going to give you a riddle, something to think about. because in the first hour we heard about how capitalism came about in the USA between the 18th and 19th centuries, and as we've heard, was intimately connected with the land theft from the Indians. Now, two episodes ago, our episode on financialization of nature, we heard about common land being brought under control by financial oligarchs, by the foreign investors, and the leaders that they'd installed to rubber stamp the process of kicking locals off the land. Now, if you're roughly my age, you will have lived through a similar process, not in Africa, but a much more talked about country, yes, I can even say a talked about empire. Where have we seen a similar story? Capitalism introduced, not exactly down the barrel of a gun, but perhaps at the point of a checkbook. That's going to prove a key element in our concluding piece on September the 11th, 2001. But first, this is The Billionaires Are in the House by Billionaires for Bush. And the video is highly recommended, either from YouTube or there's a small MPEG copy on this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/621.
Yeah. It's 50 billion here. Me and my boy Felonious Zach's gonna take the lyre down to G-Dog's crib in Crawford. And Dickie and Cola gonna bring some freaks too. Gonna have a blast.
Billionaires are here, we're men of the hour. We're sitting pretty chilling in the halls of power. We're buying access, seeing progress, and making a mess of the political process.
Oh yes,
our cheese is buying us a whole lot of leverage. When we arrive, they serve us a nice cool beverage. We're the final word on the pending legislation. Please no player hate it or the regulate it of all corporations and our industries. We're the foxes with the platinum set of hen house keys. Buying $1 billion favors for a couple of G's. We got money currency steady blowing in the breeze.
We're just living our American dream. The CEOs are playing for the Bush Cheney team. My president, he got you all scared. The billionaires are coming, so you better beware.
Step out or stretch hummers and everybody stands. Parents, lock up your daughters. Here come the billionaire.
The billionaires are in the house.
The billionaires are in the White House. We're dining on pheasant, we're dining on grouse. Yeah, the billionaires are in the house. Dick Cheney worked for us as Halliburton's chief exec. Each year we're cutting Dick another $1 million check. These federal contracts just land in our lap. We keep getting away with all the craziest. We're ripping off the Pentagon for soldiers' meals. We brought Nigerian officials making energy deals. We say Bush is our president. You know we ain't kidding. He's taking our money and doing our bid.
You wanna win the game, you gotta make the rules. We stole an election right in front of you fools. Our terror alert system got you on your knees while we're picking your pockets and snatching your cheese.
We got the USA by its curly short hair, so look out below, here come the billionaires.
The billionaires are in the house.
The billionaires are in the White House. We're sucking your blood like a bloated louse. Yeah, the billionaires are in the house. Enron is in the house.
In the White House.
Halliburton is in the house.
In the White
Fox News Corp is in the house.
In the White
House. ExxonMobil is in the house.
In the White
House. Philip Morris is in the house.
In the White
House. Monsanto is in the house.
In the White House.
This administration's preoccupation is directing the nation to wealth consolidation. All those taxes that you pay, they'll be coming our way upon a platinum trace, so don't play. No one can stop us, no one dares. Run for the hills, here come the billionaires.
I don't get tired of that video, an oldie but a goodie. Now, on to the main piece of material for this show, the inspiration for it. I found this on a website called WikiSpooks, with which I've been working for a couple of years now. It's called Collateral Damage 911 and presents a fresh argument about why the attacks of 911 were carried out. This is not in tremendous conflict with existing theories and material we've heard on the show, which tends to pinpoint a small elite of bankers, corrupt politicians, and those loosely connected to the CIA, perhaps Mossad, for organizing the events. What this does is give another motivation. I'm far from convinced that this article, as it claims, suggests the main or only motivation for the attacks of September the 11th. I think it was one amongst many. These are complicated plots, and different people who were in on what was happening no doubt tried to use it for their own advantage. Some of them very small scale. The futures trading on 9/11 represents a bit player, and some of it, as we shall hear, very large scale. The allegation centres on $240 billion of fake bonds, which were used to bring about the collapse of the Soviet economy. Now, this is an area I'm not well informed about, but from what I have seen, it does appear to have been some very shady business, with enormous oil and gas businesses particularly being sold for a song. So, as one might imagine, something of a Wild West there, but people, far from falling on their own devices, being organised with billions of dollars of foreign capital, able to pretty much take control. And that's what this article alleges. It's a very broad-ranging article. I shall be keen to hear what you think about it. If you have comments to make, you're welcome to make them on the show's discussion page. Just make yourself a login on the website. If you want to read the whole article, it's on the WikiSpook site. I'll link it in from this show's webpage. And this is how it begins. The author notes, "This is the condensed version of this story. I cannot vouch for the accuracy of source materials, although efforts have been made to validate the consistency of the storyline with as many references as possible. There's no single fact or reference this story is dependent upon. I expect some of the details to be disputed or possibly disproved, but contend that the storyline will hold true regardless." And if you'd like to read the document in its entirety, complete with images and 232 references, there's a copy on WikiSpooks. I'll link it in from this show's webpage. Collateral damage. U.S. covert operations and the terrorist attacks on September the 11th, 2001. On September the 11th, 2001, the definition of national security changed for most U.S. citizens. For an entire post-war generation, national security meant protection from nuclear attack. On that day, Americans redefined that threat. On September the 11th, 2001, three hijacked airliners hit three separate buildings with such precision and skill that many observers believe those flights were controlled by something other than poorly trained hijackers in the cockpits. This report contends that not only were the buildings targets, but that specific offices within each building were the designated targets. These offices unknowingly held information which, if exposed, subsequently would expose a national security threat of unimaginable magnitude. Protecting that secret was the motivation for the September 11th attacks. This report is about the national security secret, its origins and impact. The intent of the report is to provide a context for understanding the events of September the 11th, rather than to define exactly what happened that day. Initially, it is difficult to see a pattern to the destruction of September the 11th, other than the total destruction of the World Trade Center, a segment of the Pentagon, four commercial aircraft, and the loss of 2,993 lives. However, if the perceived objective of the attack is redefined from its commonly suggested symbolic designation as either a terrorist attack or a new Pearl Harbor, one begins by looking at it as purely a crime with specific objectives, as opposed to a political action. There is a compelling logic to the pattern of destruction. This article provides research into the early claims by Dick Eastman, Tom Flocko, V.K. Durham, and Carl Schwartz, that the September the 11th attacks were meant as a cover-up for financial crimes being investigated by the Office of Naval Intelligence, the ONI, whose offices in the Pentagon were destroyed on September the 11th. After 6 years of research, this report presents corroborating evidence which supports these claims and proposes a new rationale for the September the 11th attacks. In doing so, many of the anomalies or inconvenient facts surrounding this event take on a new meaning that is consistent with the claims of Eastman and the others. The hypothesis of this report is that the attacks of September the 11th were intended to cover up the clearing of $240 billion in securities covertly created in September 1991 to fund a covert economic war against the Soviet Union, during which unknown Western investors bought up much of the Soviet industry with a focus on oil and gas. The attacks of September the 11th also serve to derail multiple federal investigations away from crimes associated with the 1991 covert operation. In doing so, the attacks were justified under the cardinal rule of intelligence, protect your resources, and consistent with the modus operandi of sacrificing lives for a greater cause. The case for targeting of the attacks begins with analysis of the attack on the Pentagon. After one concludes that the targeting of the ONI office in the Pentagon was not random, and that information is presented later, one then must ask, is it possible that the planes that hit the World Trade Center and the bombs reported by various witnesses to have been set off inside buildings 1, 6, and 7 and the basement of the towers were deliberately located to support the execution of a crime of mind-boggling proportions? In considering that question, a pattern emerges. For the crimes alleged by Eastman, Flocko, Durham, and Schwartz to be successful, the vault in the basement of the World Trade Center and its contents, less than a billion in gold, but hundreds of billions of dollars of government securities, had to be destroyed. A critical mass of brokers from the major government security brokerages in the Twin Towers had to be eliminated to create chaos in the government securities market. A situation needed to be created wherein $240 billion of covert securities could be electronically cleared without anyone asking questions, which happened when the Federal Reserve declared an emergency and invoked its emergency powers that very afternoon. The ongoing federal investigations into the crimes funded by those securities needed to be ended or disrupted by destroying evidence in Buildings 6, 7, and 1. Finally, one has to understand and demonstrate the inconceivable that $240 billion in covert and possibly illegal government funding could have been and were created in September of 1991. Filling in that last piece of the puzzle requires understanding 50 years of history of key financial organizations in the United States, understanding how U.S. intelligence became a key source of their off-balance sheet accounts, and why this was sanctioned by every president since Truman. With that, a pattern of motivation is defined which allows government leaders and intelligence operatives to rationalize a decision to cause the death of 3,000 citizens. The World Trade Center. There were three major securities brokers in the World Trade Center: Cantor Fitzgerald, Eurobrokers, and Gabon Intercapital. On the morning of September the 11th, Flight 11 hit the North Tower at 8:46, right below the floors on which Cantor Fitzgerald was situated. Cantor Fitzgerald was the largest securities dealer in the US, and arguably the primary target. Shortly after that, a massive explosion went off just under the FBI offices in the North Tower on the 23rd floor, and Gabon Intercapital on the 25th floor. and in the basement of Tower 1 as well. The explosion caused the 22nd through 25th floors above to collapse into an inferno. Fires were reported on the 22nd floor at 8:47. Shortly thereafter, at 9:03, Flight 175 hit the South Tower, right below the floors on which Eurobrokers were situated. In all three cases, the explosive, fiery destruction consumed the offices in several floors above. At 9:37, Flight 77 hit the Pentagon, targeting one of the few offices that had been moved in the newly remodeled section of the Pentagon, the Office of Naval Intelligence. Agents of the Office of Naval Intelligence had been investigating the financial transactions which in this report are linked to the securities being managed by those security dealers in the World Trade Center that were targeted. Fortunately, most other agencies had not yet been moved back into the targeted section of the Pentagon. 41% of the fatalities in the Twin Towers came from the two companies that managed U.S. government securities, Cantor Fitzgerald and Eurobrokers. 31% of the 125 fatalities in the Pentagon were from the Naval Command Center that housed the Office of Naval Intelligence. 39 out of 40 of the Office of Naval Intelligence employees died. In the vaults beneath the World Trade Center towers, any certificates for bonds were destroyed. Building 7 was evacuated somewhere between 9 o'clock and 9:30, depending on various claims. Fires and explosions simultaneously began at multiple locations inside the building prior to the collapse of either tower. This observation is critical in that the official explanation for the fire is that they started when objects from the collapsing towers caused the fires to ignite. Witnesses leaving the building claim to have seen fires already starting and dead bodies. The building ultimately was destroyed in what many unofficial observers now believe was a controlled demolition. Building 7 housed the following agencies critical to investigation of financial crimes related to this history: the Export-Import Bank of the U.S. on Floor 6, the U.S. Secret Service on Floors 9 and 10, Securities and Exchange Commission, Floors 11 through 13, the International Revenue Service, Floors 24 and 25, the CIA on Floor 25, and the Department of Defense on Floor 25. The U.S. Secret Service Special Agent David Curran, the number three guy in that office, said, quote, "All the evidence that we stored at 7 World Trade in all our cases went down with the building. We lost our network, we lost all our computers, we lost all the equipment that we use as Secret Service agents, everything from machine guns to our shotguns to our electronic equipment that we use. A lot of cases had to be closed as a result of losing that building." Unquote. In the midst of all this, Building 6 was destroyed by explosions from within before being buried in the rubble of the towers. FEMA, the agency charged with investigating this disaster, did not collect any data on this building. Building 6 was home to the U.S. Customs Agency and the El Dorado Task Force, an interagency money laundering group from 55 agencies created in 1992. The El Dorado Task Force was responsible for coordinating all major money laundering investigations in the U.S. In the immediate aftermath of September the 11th, these groups would be redirected to investigate terrorist financing. On the same day, the Securities and Exchange Commission declared a national emergency and, for the first time in U.S. history, invoked its emergency powers under the Securities Exchange Act, Section 12K, and eased regulatory restrictions for clearing and settling security trades for the next 15 days. These changes would allow an estimated $240 billion in covert government securities to be cleared upon maturity without the standard regulatory controls around identification of ownership. And the manner in which this was accomplished is explained later in this report. The Pentagon. It must be noted that the Office of Naval Intelligence in the Pentagon, which sustained a direct hit on that day, was, without doubt, a target that was pinpointed for destruction. There are a number of indicators that this was the case. The command centers of the U.S. Armed Forces and the Office of the Secretary of Defense are located on the River and Mall, northern-facing segments of the Pentagon. This is public information. Either of those facades should have been the prime target for a well-planned attack. It needs to be remembered that the individuals responsible for September the 11th had almost 3 years to plan their assault. The targets and methods were not haphazard. The western-facing section of the Pentagon that was attacked had been under construction for almost 2 years and would not have been considered as a target unless it was targeted for a specific reason. The Naval Command Center had been moved into that newly opened section of the Pentagon a month earlier. The attacking aircraft went through great effort to hit the west side of the Pentagon, under either of contentious scenarios, looping around the Pentagon by 270 degrees after approaching from the northeast, or looping 360 degrees with its approach from the west. Under either scenario, the additional looping created an opportunity with extra flight time for defense systems to take out an attacking plane, and the hijackers took a significant risk of being shot down by executing this maneuver. If one looks carefully at the Kuppel flight path approach seen in Figure 1, and there's a diagram, the attacking flight path went almost directly over the White House, bypassing what should be considered a primary target for a supposedly empty section of the Pentagon. With the alternative approach presented by the National Transportation Safety Board, the extra distance in the loop would have allowed it to hit either the White House or the Capitol, had it continued straight forward. Derek Vreeland, who claimed to be an agent for the ONI, had predicted the attack several weeks in advance. The ONI has been attributed by several sources with responsibility for leaking copies of the faxes which document the illegal transaction of 1989 to 91. Did Flight 77 pass on three primary targets? The White House, the Capitol, and the command centers in the north face of the Pentagon, in order to make a precision hit on what should have been known to be an empty segment of the Pentagon? Did the pilot, described as having extraordinary skill after years of planning, hit a worthless target? It would seem the assumption has to be the pilot hit exactly where he wanted to hit. The planes hitting the South Tower and Pentagon maneuvered in those last moments to hit their exact target. With a world of targets available, why these? For the majority of Americans, the unanswered questions regarding that day are legion. While many of the questions may never be answered, the extraordinary destruction experienced at locations in the World Trade Center and the peculiar targeting of the Pentagon all support a pattern of deliberate destruction of sites key to the claims of Eastman, Durham, Flocko, and Schwartz. While most media reports defer to the U.S. government contention that Osama bin Laden was behind these attacks, foreign media provided reports suggesting that the real power behind al-Qaeda was unknown. As shall be seen, the financial power behind the attack is the same power that created these securities, and the same power as that which funded Al-Qaeda. The origins of the World Trade Center attack. Most historians track the history of September the 11th to 1998, when Osama bin Laden declared a fatwa, or jihad, against the US, and the terrorist Hamburg Group, led by Mohammed Atta, reportedly offered its services to Al-Qaeda. However, the history which defines the motives for the September the 11th attacks goes much further back in time. The answers to the questions surrounding the cause of the World Trade Center attack will be found in events going back as far as 1990 and 91, when George H.W. Bush was president. To a very great degree, insight into the activities of that period are cloaked by the executive order of George H.W. Bush's son, President George W. Bush, who, on November 1, 2001, issued Executive Order 13233. This executive order was intended to balance the public's right to see the records of past presidents with a need to protect national security. As a result, public records which might have shed light on the activities of 1990 and 91 remain shielded from public access in the interest of national security and the men and women who support it. Subsequently, this reconstruction of the events from the late 1980s and early 1990s is based on news reports, books, and articles. What the public record suggests is that, with the beginning of the first Bush presidency in 1989, George H.W. Bush initiated a program of covert economic warfare to bring about the collapse of the Soviet Union. The name of this program appears to be Project Hammer, a previously reported multi-billion dollar covert operation, a Third World Investment Program, whose investments remain shielded. This program consisted of four major covert operations, including 1. The theft of the Soviet treasury, 2. Currency destabilization of the ruble, 3. Funding of the KGB generals August 1991 coup against Gorbachev, and 4. Takeover of the key energy and defense industries in the Soviet Union. At its inception, the program was conducted well within policy framework of the US government, as defined by several executive orders, authored by Vice President Bush and signed by President Ronald Reagan. There's good reason to believe that the plan was initially formulated by Reagan's CIA director, William Casey. During World War II, before Casey headed OSS operations in Europe, he worked for the Board of Economic Warfare, and his role was, quote, pinpointing Hitler's economic jugular and investigating how it could be squeezed, unquote. Many of the program operatives were probably engaged through official CIA and national security channels. However, as a result of experience gained by the Bush cabinet and its private sector counterparts during the secretive Iran-Contra and Ferdinand Marcos Gold operations, which will be explained in short order, the execution of that program would be accompanied by two new assumptions. 1. Using covert and illegal funding for a policy not approved by Congress would remain acceptable. Under George H.W. Bush, congressional oversight of covert operations could be ignored with impunity. And 2. The American public and their representatives in Congress were too preoccupied with their own lives to be worried about what happened in foreign lands, even if those actions violated the law and the Constitution. Emboldened by the lack of consequences for subverting the US Constitution and breaking international law during the Iran-Contra scandal, the Bush administration group known as the Vulcans planned a bigger drive to crush the soul of communism once and for all. this group had graced themselves with this moniker, naming themselves after the... Roman god of war, Vulcan. They waged war against the Soviet Union and Iraq under George H.W. Bush and against Iraq and Afghanistan under George W. Bush. Belonging to this group were Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Armitage, and Condoleezza Rice. The Vulcans' drive to bring an end to the Cold War was fueled by a covert war chest invisible to congressional oversight. This war chest would be known by several names: Black Eagle Trust, the Marcos Gold, Yamashita's Gold, the Golden Lily Treasure, the Durham Trust, or Project Hammer. These same Vulcans would be brought back to power in 2000 under the administration of President George W. Bush, son of President George H.W. Bush. The covert operations conducted by the Vulcans involved, at a minimum, potential securities fraud, money laundering, and violation of Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. In a number of situations, murder and false imprisonment seemed to be the mainstay of efforts to prevent any remorseful participants in this operation from going public with their stories. While accomplishing its objective, bringing about the demise of the Soviet Union, the program also seems to have lined the pockets of the individuals that executed this policy at U.S. taxpayer expense. This was done to the tune of a mere $240 billion in covert and allegedly illegal bonds, which appear to have been replaced with treasury notes backed by U.S. taxpayers in the aftermath of September the 11th. 17 years later, in 2008, the personal financial empires of those who benefited directly from these covert securities should now stand at several $1 trillion and are rightfully the property of various citizenries. Putin's purge of selected oligarchs is consistent with this story. The covert securities used to accomplish the original national security objective of ending the Cold War ended up in the vaults of the brokers in the World Trade Center and were destroyed on September the 11th, 2001. They came due for settlement and clearing on September the 12th. The federal agency investigating these bonds, the Office of Naval Intelligence, was in the section of the Pentagon that was destroyed on September the 11th. To a key group of senior national security officials who had participated in the victory of the economic Cold War in 1991, the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, the four airliners and their occupants would become collateral damage in the ending of the Cold War. Their deaths were required to hide the existence of the Black Eagle Trust and the covert activities it had funded for over 50 years. This alternative view of these events suggests that the destruction of these lives and buildings constituted a cover-up of continued lawlessness by a fraternity or brotherhood of businessmen and criminals, often referred to as the Enterprise in the 1980s, but which has remained in the shadows ever since. And that's where I'm going to stop the initial reading. It then goes on to describe the origins of the war chest, a huge amount of gold and other valuables captured from the Japanese at the end of World War II, which those involved decided not to declare, and instead kept it secret and used it for their own purposes. And these main purposes seem to be cementing control over the world's financial system by a small number of banks who were beholden to them. And they work closely with arms dealers and intelligence agencies to take control over the world's political processes. And the arms to Iran-Contra scandal gets a mention as possibly the last time The profile of this group and what they were up to was clearly visible. Regulars to the show will recognize many of these names, and whilst this is well outside the imagination of those schooled in corporate media, some of what I read seems distressingly familiar. BCCI, various apparently unrelated scandals, if we believe the commercially controlled media, appear to be connected, both in terms of it was the same people involved, and the one money laundering scheme was connected to the next scheme, which needed money to buy weapons. George Bush, Adnan Khashoggi, Oliver North, Paul Wolfowitz. These are government players, CIA players, arms dealers. Barrick Gold gets a mention. And then they decided, we have the resources to wage economic war on the Soviet Union. So, it's the same suspects. If you've done research into the Soviet coup plot of 1991, connections with Mossad, the CIA, BCCI, a lot of dark corners, and the overarching picture is self-interested people, yes, greedy, unprincipled people, yes, but also people with a vision, perhaps a religious fervor, that capitalism was good and must be spread by whatever means necessary. So, yeah, we may have heard a story in the West that the people of the Soviet Union wanted to be free, and that was what brought down the Soviet Union, people's innate desire for capitalism. Well, some sort of parallel there with a story about how capitalism brings wealth and prosperity, so of course people are going to want this when they don't have it. Now, there are one or two typos in the document, one or two spelling mistakes, which is some sort of evidence for me to make me question how worked on it's been and or the scholarship behind it. However, as I say, a lot of information, well presented and with a compelling narrative, one that fits with some of my areas of knowledge. Now, I should be glad to hear your areas of knowledge. Did you know the Federal Reserve suspended the rules on September the 11th to allow blind trading? That's trading without the normal standards of accountability. Lots of stuff there. Well, perhaps the biggest point, which I'm surprised didn't make it in, is the fact that on September the 10th, as we noted in a 9/11 special edition, on the day before, a certain Donald Rumsfeld announced $2.3 trillion, which couldn't be accounted for, from Pentagon funds. Well, that dwarfs even the $240 billion of bonds that this article talks about. And this document doesn't purport to be a complete explanation, so if you've got theories of your own, we'll begin to hear them. So, it talks about the economic acts taken against the Soviet Union, the organizing of the coup attempt in 1999, and the bonds used for the destabilization that were issued in 1991 that would have become due on September 11th, 2001, presenting a problem. Well, a lot of the exchanges where they would have been cleared were physically destroyed, a lot of records were destroyed, a lot of key people were either killed in the attacks or could be killed later with the attacks as cover. And it says the Federal Reserve suspended the rules because of the emergency to allow transactions which would otherwise have been debarred by security controls. So it allowed blind brokered transactions, which made it easier to pass off these fake securities, apparently. It changed the rules for failed trades to flood the market with these failed trades, again providing unusual activity and facilitating the burying of these records. So, a lot of quotes, a lot of references, somebody's done a lot of work to try and get to the bottom of this. It all on one level, reinforces David Graeber's point that the financial crisis, which is related by the author in a sequel to this article to this scam, was a fantastically complicated Ponzi scheme. There's a question of, okay, well, what do we do about it? And I think I owe it to the author to present his conclusion after a lot of facts. So here it is. Conclusion. History has many interpretations, and this report has been just one of many. An interpretation pieced together from the bold admissions and revelations of insiders, whose stories have been ignored and suppressed by major media organizations. It's an interpretation of history that suggests a few determined men strove to change the world in defense of Western capitalism, in ways which they felt needed to be hidden from the public. Whatever emotion or logic that was adequate to cause them to hide their actions from the public was not strong enough to prevent them from committing the acts. In changing the world, crimes were committed for the good of the American public, without the American public having a say in what it thought was in its best interest. To cover up these crimes, thousands of innocent people had to be murdered. Hundreds of thousands of people across the globe have been subjected to the terrors of wars funded by this operation. The few good men responsible for these events make sure no one knows who is responsible, because, in their hearts, they know that what they do is not acceptable to the American public. The alleged statements by Bush and Reagan are testimony to that point. Sarah McClendon reports asking, what will the people do if they ever find out the truth about Iraqgate and Iran-Contra? She reports George H.W. Bush's reply, Sarah, if the American people ever find out what we've done, they'll chase us down the streets and lynch us. And William J. Casey reports Reagan as saying, if such a story gets out, we'll all be hanging by our thumbs in front of the White House. It might be fair to rationalize their crimes as collateral damage in a war to preserve the American standard of living, and that because they risk their lives to serve the American public, they are entitled to reap the spoils of war. If thousands had to die to enrich the life and secure liberty for millions, is that not an acceptable sacrifice? It might also be fair to suggest that these agents were nothing more than a criminal association of sociopaths and psychopaths, out to enrich themselves by means of violence, who have murdered thousands, destroyed the lives of tens of thousands, and caused endless misery, pain, and death for millions in foreign lands. As a brotherhood always at war, they live under a motto of results at any cost, and they spin a web of deceit which allows the American public to tolerate their crimes. It might be fair to view the politicians who use them as realists, who accept the existence of both kinds of men and use them to preserve and protect the American public, and like generals in war, be forced to make hard decisions on behalf of the citizenry. It might also be fair to view the politicians as opportunists, who use the agents for their own personal gain. Most of these politicians made their fortunes by capitalizing on the death and misery of war, which they forced others into unwillingly and through deception. They have insider trading knowledge of secret funds that in actuality belong to the American public, and unlimited personal access to those funds. Regardless of any personal interpretation, the process for ascertaining truth, which is held consistent with the values of the American public, has been a trial by jury, where the prosecutors and defense abide by the law to conduct a fair and impartial hearings of the facts. This report is based on hearsay evidence, and as a result proves nothing. Hopefully, what it does is define hypotheses to be proven by subsequent archive research. Americans had a chance in the 1980s to set the system straight, to enforce the law, and prosecute those responsible for the Iran-Contra crimes. Americans could have sent a message that criminal behavior by its leaders is unacceptable. By not stopping this organization at that time, Congress and the American public allowed this criminal syndicate of American heroes to continue to wreak even more havoc on the world in the name of the American public. This assault on the Constitution, freedom, democracy, the Geneva Convention, and the rule of domestic and international law has continued unabated for over 50 years. By refusing to reopen the widely discredited inquiry called the 9/11 Commission, and by refusing to address the covert funding that feeds this syndicate without accountability, the Congress seemingly becomes co-conspirator to past and future crimes. Ronald Reagan was correct.
America will never make concessions to terrorists. To do so would only invite more terrorism. Once we head down that path, there would be no end to it. No end to the suffering of innocent people, no end to the bloody ransom all civilized nations must pay.
Before his death, Earl Koch testified that he thought the whole operation had become too big for anyone to determine how to bring closure to it, and that those who wanted to see it ended just gave up. Given the thousands of people who've been murdered to keep this secret, and given the way witnesses that could implicate this group are treated, maybe those that gave up were encouraged to do so. Two questions remain. One, does the American public want to bring an end to this covert war? And two, is there a way to bring this to closure? Two American presidents, Kennedy and Carter, tried to bring this organization under control, and both were beaten by the machine. Hopefully, the lessons of their shortcomings will provide success in a third attempt. Now, I'm going to question whether we really need a president to bring this organization under control. That, to me, seems to support the notion that hierarchy can fix this. I think we need a bottom-up approach. Every time we use money, we are supporting the system. We can't, on the one hand, continue to use money, and on the other hand, be surprised that the system has control over us and the environment around us. And this is why I'm encouraging people to give what they can. I'm not asking, giving money. Just do what you want to do. Give to other people in faith. Challenge that supposition that everybody is out for themselves. I think the more people who do, the easier it'll be for everyone else to say, well, that's not true, we're not all selfish. I remember that chap who gave me this. As we heard in the first hour, capitalism never used to have this hold over people's imaginations and their lives. David Graeber, as the chapter concludes, I think becomes more and more eloquent in his argument that capitalism had a beginning and it will have an end. And it's down to us, people not seeking to dominate others, to create an end of it. Does it seem terribly naive to think just stepping away from the machine, bit by bit, becoming less involved in money, giving altruistically to people, could be a successful way to shake off the domination of the machine? Well, it's certainly not using the master's tools to destroy the master's house. To bring in a metaphor from Charles Eisenstein, even the key question as asked in the article, does the American public want to bring an end to this covert war? I think that's a very salient question, but I wouldn't limit it to America. I think all the nation states of the world, more or less, are involved in this. It doesn't limit itself to the US. Everywhere you look, there are good people doing bad things and justifying this in the name of, well, I got to make a living. Do we, humanity, actually want to bring an end to this system? Well, that's a question that was never asked on the commercially controlled media, and that's why I'm asking it. Are you morally entitled to that which you can pay for? Wealth derives ultimately from the productive capacity of land, all of which used to be held in common. It was understood that it wasn't anybody's private property. Who got to be the person who owned that land? Well, yep, it was the people at the land registry. They had a lot of power. But also other people who were good at kicking other people off their land and putting fences up. So ultimately, it derives from violence. The question whether you have a moral right to what you can pay for is, in one sense, a disguised way of asking, does might make right? If we accept that it does, life becomes a lot simpler, and of course, as I would argue, a lot cheaper. It may be that you live such a marginal life that the tiniest act of altruism will bring about your own destruction through lack of food or lack of resources. Well, Chris Hedges might argue that you should do it anyway if you think it's the right thing, because to capitulate to self-interest in a narrow sense is to accept the capitalist paradigm. I think it's very unlikely, if you're listening to this show, that you haven't got some slack. Americans consume vastly more than Bangladeshis on average. And do they feel any more secure? Would they perhaps feel more secure if they took the approach of the piraha, as Charles Eisenstein remarks, storing food in the belly of their brother? I think material wealth is vastly overrated as a source of security and comfort, particularly in these uncertain times. I think strength of relationships, connections to people around one, is the true wealth, something that is very close to becoming globally apparent to almost everybody, almost simultaneously. As David Graeber would say, there's a vast machine dedicated to perpetuating hopelessness, that all these debts will have to be repaid. We know it's mathematically impossible, and people somehow are forced to thinking in the selfish frame in which they personally will try desperately to do it anyway, regardless of the cost to their neighbor. What about if people just said, this is killing the planet, let's not do it. Let's do something else. Growing local food would be a good thing in almost all circumstances. Carrying somebody's shopping bag if they need a hand. Giving somebody a listening ear. We all have things that we can give. I never tire of reflecting on how Lynn Gehry's gift of this program to me has changed my life. Does capitalism necessarily only have to end in a nuclear holocaust or a global famine or a global epidemic caused by a GM product gone mad or antibiotic resistant supervirus? It could end in a lot of nasty ways. Or might it just end because everybody said, well, this is not a good system. Why don't we just go back to what we used to do and give things to each other? This and all previous episodes of the show are available as gifts to the wider world. We hope it gives you food for thought. All Unwelcome Guest shows are downloadable from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a Twitter feed announcing new episodes at twitter.com/unwelcomeguests. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening, and keep giving all you can. The rich will come down.